Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 6.
Hey everybody, welcome to Tokyo Podcast. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new iPhone 4S that was released in Japan, as well as a quick update on the flooding situation in Thailand. Hey everybody, welcome to Tokyo Podcast. Well, on today's show, I'm going to be talking to a guy named Paul Papadimitrio, who runs a website called mobileinjapan.com, and we're going to be talking about the new iPhone 4S that was recently released. As you know, the Apple model is quite different than many of the other iPhone companies here in Japan, and so it's been really interesting to see the Japanese consumer reaction to the iPhone. I myself have ordered one, and I am waiting very patiently to get my email that my iPhone is ready to be picked up. So I'm going to be talking to him a little bit later in the show. But first, I have a special guest, a blast from the past. Mr. Greg Jorgensen is joining me from Bangkok. As you may or may not know, Greg and I hosted Bangkok Podcast for over a year, and he's here now to talk about the current flooding situation in Bangkok. Hey, buddy, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, good to be on again. How you doing?
Good.
Cool, cool.
Feels weird to be back on the air with the Greginator.
Just like old times.
Just like old times. Bringing the real news to the world.
That's right. Street level views from the big cities.
So what I wanted to talk to you about is what is going on in Bangkok? Are you building the ark? Are you floating away? If you watch the news, it's all flooding. If you try to follow along what the Thai government is saying, no idea what's going on with that. I don't even think they have any idea what's going on.
No, it's amazing. Did you
hear that someone posted that the rescue helicopters are missing parts so they can't use them?
Yeah. And I read something today too, and I think it was a joke. I hope it was a joke, that because the U.S. is sending a bunch of rescue experts to help with coordinating the rescue operation. But everyone's like, do they have work permits? No one. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But, you know, the real story is that, I mean, a lot of Thailand, especially in the central plains, they've been really hit hard. And, you know, when you've got water up to your neck in your living room, like, there's big problems, you know. And the biggest problem right now is the economic fallout, because the Ayutthaya area, which is the ancient capital of Thailand, then Siam, is about an hour drive north of Bangkok. And that's where all of these huge, huge industrial estates are, you know, Toyota, Nissan, Western Digital, all these massive international companies have their factories. And that whole area is in a basin. So that basically just filled up and shut everything down. There's hundreds of thousands of people out of work. There's millions and millions of dollars worth of damage. So it's going to take a really long time to recover from that, even after the water is gone.
Is that area really in a basin?
Yeah, it's like a natural, like, I think they call it a catchment area. It's just sort of a natural valley, I guess.
So they built an industrial area in a catchment area?
Apparently, they warned them not to, but for some reason, they went ahead and did it anyway.
You know, and that's a huge problem, not only for Thailand, but also for Japan, because after the earthquake in Japan, many of the companies like Toyota, Honda, they moved extra production to Thailand.
Sure, totally,
because the factories up north in Sendai were washed away. So they moved a lot of that production to Thailand. And now you're saying that many of those factories are actually not able to work at all either.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I work in logistics, right? Like, I work at a magazine that deals with supply chains and international shipping. And I mean, this goes all the way down the line. So one factory stops here, then that means the ship that was on its way here from South Africa doesn't have anything to pick up, you know, so it goes down the line. So then, the cargo that was coming to South Africa, that has nowhere to go. And the cargo that was coming, you know, like, it's a really big knock-on effect, and it's having a big, big effect, like a ripple effect all throughout the world. So I think the economic effects of this will be felt for a really, really long time. That being said, if I didn't watch the news, I wouldn't know that there was flooding going on. I live in central Bangkok, and it's just business as usual.
Really? So you're not walking around at your, you know, on your boat or anything like that? It's everything is open. Stores are open. Transportation's open.
Yeah.
All in Bangkok?
Well, I do have a giant pair of those Dutch clogs, those shoes made out of wood, just in case. No, it's, yeah, everything's open, man. I mean, there's been some unusually heavy rain, that's for sure, especially today. It was just on and off all day, just torrential. But, you know, no, it's you know, I walk to the SkyTrain every day. I go to work. It's just totally, totally business as usual. And I feel really bad because here, you know, in Bangkok, everyone is like making it into this huge international incident, like Bangkok, we have to save Bangkok. And meanwhile, you know, millions and millions of other Thai people are waiting around their living room and, you know, walking into electrical sockets and dying. You know, like it seems really slanted. It just doesn't seem right. But
yeah, I was thinking the other day, I mean, it's kind of bad to say this, but I think that if Bangkok had flooded, there would have been a lot of preparation done to prevent this happening again next year. But because Bangkok wasn't flooded, you can bet there won't be as much action taken to prevent this happening next year. You know, it seems the case with Thailand. You know, it's always like, oh, it's those other people's problem.
Yeah.
If it's not in Bangkok, it's somewhere else. It might be a lie. You know, it doesn't matter.
You kind of see both sides of the argument. I mean, Bangkok is the financial and, you know, transportation hub of the entire country. So it does have a sort of a, I mean, it is an important thing to save the city, but, and it's not like they weren't trying to save the other areas too, but, you know, I just feel a bit bad that, you know, my shoes haven't even been wet. And, you know, then, you know, thousands of other people in Thailand are, you know, suffering and going without food and fresh water and getting diseases because they just can't get help to them.
I heard that 10,000 crocodiles have been released or broke free from a zoo or something like that. So there's all these crocodiles and poisonous snakes floating in the water as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a friend of the podcast, both Tokyo Podcast and Bangkok Podcast, Richard Barrow, he said he lives out in close to the river, and he said he picked a snake up out of his living room the other day. So,
no way, really?
Yeah, or I mean, it was someone's living room. You picked a snake up out of someone's house anyway. But yeah, now there's a 1,000 baht reward for catching these crocodiles, dead or alive.
Yeah, I heard that. So okay. So in Bangkok, everything is pretty much business as normal.
Yeah, the central business area of Bangkok and the tourist areas, like in the Ratanakosin down by the Grand Palace, is totally fine. Siloam is fine. The entire stretch of Sukhumvit is fine. Basically, the subway and SkyTrain lines and the roads and areas around those are like nothing even happened, and sort of several kilometers out in either direction as well. But the further you get into the suburbs of Bangkok, then you start to worry. And of course, the river right along the river is definitely flooded. But most of Bangkok is just business as usual, although everyone is really aware of what could happen if things go tits up, you know.
And what are the officials saying? Is the worst over for Bangkok, or is there more risk of flooding?
I think generally the worst is over, yeah. But again, they're saying that the tidal conditions and the extra flood and rain conditions will again form sort of a perfect storm around the end of October. So I think most people think that the worst is over, but we're not out of the woods yet. So we'll see. The only thing we can do is wait, right?
Right. Right. And what are they saying? Do they have any estimates of how long it's going to take for this water to clear out?
I read something online today that said about 40 to 50 days, but I don't know where that number came from. So, but yeah, I imagine so.
So almost 2 months then. Have you seen their plan to push the water out to the ocean using those boats on the Chao Phraya River?
Yeah.
You know, I kind of looked online to see if that's either really smart or really dumb. I can't figure it out.
Well, actually,
Maybe there's some engineers that can kick in, but I mean, is that actually working or what?
Oh, well, depends who you ask. You know, if you ask me, I'm high and dry. I'm like, damn, it seemed to work. You know, you ask the people near the river and they're like, that's bull crap, nothing worked. But it's funny you mentioned that. I actually sent several emails today to some fluid dynamics institutes around the world just to see if I could get some insight into that. But I haven't heard back from them yet. Generally, I think the consensus is that it's a stupid idea.
Well, I went to the experts at Mythbusters, that TV show, you know, and I posted on their forum. And
I think I saw
generally
that.
People were saying that they don't think that the propellers from the boats can generate enough push to move that much water, you know.
Yeah, it'd be like trying to create enough lift for an airplane with a you know, a fan, living room fan, you know, just
right.
The volumes,
the amount of water is just too much.
Yeah, just way too much.
So Bangkok is basically safe. I've heard that Chiang Mai and some of those areas are safe, not flooded.
I've got a few friends in Chiang Mai right now, and they're fine.
And then down south, the main tourist areas like Phuket and Pattaya and some of those areas, they're not flooded at all, right?
No. I mean, once it hits the ocean, it's sort of done. So it was just the landlocked northern part of Thailand that all this water is coming from. Once it gets down into the Chao Phraya Basin and into the ocean, then it's gone.
Right. So if any tourists are, because I know Richard Barrows has mentioned that a lot of people are emailing, wondering if they should cancel their holiday plans to Thailand, especially, you know, coming up in October, November is start of the tourist season. And I guess we would say that if you're heading up to Chiang Mai or heading north up that area, you're fine. If you're heading down south, which most of them do, you should be fine. Bangkok should be fine. The only areas are the areas around Ayutthaya. If you're heading into that area, that area is still quite flooded.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a Google crisis response that shows some very good maps of what areas are flooded right now. And it's basically only like a couple of kilometers on either side of the Chao Phraya River as it moves up towards the northern Thailand. Beyond that, I'd say most of Thailand is business as usual. But yeah, Ayutthaya is going to be off the map for a few more months, I think.
Right. So it's going to take a while for that water to clear out.
Yeah. If you see, there's a couple of pictures that have been up online over the past few days. So a couple of guys took an airplane ride over Ayutthaya. And it looks apocalyptic, like just water as far as you can see. So,
well, you know, our good friend, the Orange Jedi, Prat Pandit, who we've had on Bangkok Podcast many times, he's posted some pictures of his university. And have you seen those?
Man.
I mean,
it's crazy.
It's like an island in the middle of the ocean. It's like all around it is water.
Yeah, no doubt. It's nuts. And a friend of mine actually works at the Western Digital plant up in Ayutthaya. He makes hard drives there. And he sent a tweet out yesterday morning, I think, that said something like, $20 million lab, just a write-off. Gone, toast.
So, yeah, I saw that. Yeah, so I think it's going to be, that area is going to be underwater for a while. If you're looking for more information online about this, you would definitely recommend following Richard Barrows on Twitter. He seems to be right on top of everything that's going on in Thailand, as always. Uh-huh. I've also found a website, a Facebook page called facebook.com/ThaiFloodENG, short for English, which seems to have a lot of good information about the flooding as well.
Yeah, and also if you do a Thai flood ENG hashtag search on Twitter, it'll bring up all the tweets related to that. There are a lot of people tweeting it. I mean, Richard Barrow is he's the main dude, but there's a lot of other people all over the place that are tweeting as well, and they all use that hashtag. So it's a good way to keep on top of things.
Right. Cool. Okay, cool. Well, thanks, buddy. Thanks for coming on the show and giving us the update about the situation in Bangkok.
No problem. If I don't float away, I hope to see you soon.
For sure. Ciao.
Okay.
Well, I am extremely pleased to welcome to the show today Mr. Paul Papadimitrio, who runs a website called mobileinjapan.com. He is also vice president and principal analyst at Constellation Research, which is a tech consulting firm. And I am extremely pleased to talk to him today because I am very excited about getting my iPhone 4S next week. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hello. Thank you, Tony. Thanks.
Now, you run a website called mobileinjapan.com. And I got to tell you that being a foreigner here, being a gaijin here, and trying to get my mobile phone, I have found it to be a rather difficult process. And especially compared to Bangkok, where you can get a mobile phone in a number in 5-10 minutes.
It's true that in Japan, it's really surprising when you're not used to it. That was the idea behind Mobile in Japan. It was not even called Mobile in Japan at that point. I was in a, so the first iPhone was released in Japan was a 3G because there's no more 2G network in Japan. So it was in July 11, 2008. And I went to the, you know, I was very excited like you are. And I went to the SoftBank store. I had no information. There was no information in English on any website. There was almost no one spoke English in the shop. My Japanese was very poor back then. So I didn't know what kind of papers I should bring. And all like you, I mean, I was under the impression I should just go there. Like in 10 minutes, I would go out with my phone and my number and I could start calling and using all the applications. But no, of course not. It took me almost 2 hours and I had luckily had all the right papers. And that's when on the same evening, I started writing a blog entry to basically explain all the process I went through and what papers were needed and what people should be expecting. I've wrote a few blog entries like this. That was in the summer of 2008. So the whole inception of mobile in Japan was you because of the iPhone.
So when you went down there initially, I went down to SoftBank and it took me about, luckily there was actually a couple of English speakers there. One girl actually from my hometown in Vancouver, Canada, kind of walked me through the whole procedure. So it took me about 30 minutes to order my phone and my iPad. How long did it take you the first time?
So there was no iPad back then. it took me about 2 hours. No, the queue notwithstanding, obviously there was people queuing up like today. So it took me about 2 hours, mostly because of the loss in translation, but mostly I would even say SoftBank, like any other mobile carrier, and SoftBank was the only one having the iPhone back then, was not really prepared for foreigners. They had like a hard time really knowing what we were supposed to bring as papers. And also they asked us, all foreigners back then, to pay for the iPhone up front. The old cost of the iPhone, which didn't really change because overall you pay your iPhone over the 24 month of the usual contract period anyway. But that was quite the experience, which is why I found it so complicated, so much papers that was the reason of deception. But nowadays, SoftBank, if you go to their website, they have translated pretty much all the information in English, and you can actually they have. All the steps written down, all the papers you should bring, you know, your famous gaijin card, as we call it, and other papers. So I would say that SoftBank, compared to KDDI, AU KDDI, which is the other mobile operator who was carrying the iPhone for us, SoftBank is more gaijin friendly, to be honest. So you were lucky to go there. Plus, the shop you chose, the one at Omotesando, Harajuku Omotesando, is probably the shop that is attracts most of the foreign community in Japan.
Of the three carriers here, the SoftBank, KDDI, and Docomo, which one, aside from the iPhone, which one would you say is the most gaijin friendly?
No, it is SoftBank, but the thing, so to put it in perspective, Docomo is by far the biggest operator. It's the number one. They have almost 50 million user subscribers. Then you have KDDI second and SoftBank in third. SoftBank has roughly, let's say, 22, 23 million subscribers out of a market of 127 million. There's actually more phones and subscribers than the population in Japan because some people have two phones. That was actually the case when the iPhone was released, because the iPhone at the beginning and still now to some point was a totally different experience from the traditional Japanese phone, who has accesses to portals that are created by the carrier. So people would buy an iPhone but would still hold to their own Keitai. Gaijin friendly, I mean, SoftBank, just by its history, it used to be called Vodafone. It was a foreign network. I mean, it was there were Vodafone International had equity in the current SoftBank. Then SoftBank bought it back. The other reason why SoftBank obviously made all these efforts in translating their information in English, because the other two carriers also have information in English, but because the iPhone was at first when it was released very much thought as a foreign phone, and a lot of gaijins were obviously willing to buy it. So very quickly, they turned all the information in English. I mean, very quickly. I'm being very nice there. It took them several months, but it like in Japan. But at least they went this extra mile, and they still do, because if you go to the KDDI website today to actually check any information to get an iPhone from them, the information is not in English at all. You cannot understand what exactly they're asking for, even though it's very similar from SoftBank, if you do not speak Japanese. So they are, I would say, the most gaijin friendly on the surface. Now, if you want to buy a phone at Docomo, honestly, there's no problem. I mean, I've got many friends who are either anti-Apple or because they would prefer other, they would rather have a phone from Docomo, and the process to buy to remain in the smartphone world, to buy an Android or Samsung, for instance, is very easy as well. So it's a, I wouldn't say on the surface, because of the, all the information translated into English, it seems that SoftBank would be the most gadget friendly, but Docomo is also very easy. Now, why would people, the other thing that I should mention here, why would people, why people are loving Docomo is because the quality of the network is certainly the best, is Docomo's network. It's the quality overall, all over Japan, not only in Tokyo, is top notch. Number two is KDDI, and number three, SoftBank. SoftBank has some limitation in some parts of the country. Even in Tokyo, you realize it's sometimes the network drops a little. I never had any issues with it, but still, overall, over the three networks, is the one that has the lesser one. It's also due because they do not have access to what it's called an 800 gigahertz band. It's a band, basically, SoftBank will have a harder time reaching tunnels or the underground system than the two other, because they haven't had yet, at least because the CEO is fighting for it, they haven't had the access to that band, extra band, so the extra bandwidth, if you want, for voice and data to be carried from.
I've heard about that. Does that affect both data and voice, or just voice calls?
So I'm... If I take my own experience, I'm the kind of guy who does 99% of data and 1% of voice.
Right. Same with me.
I never really, honestly, in Tokyo, I never encountered any problem. And now, it was the 800 megahertz, not gigahertz. Sorry for that. Just I want to correct myself. So I never really had. It's true that some people say the performance is lesser now. Okay, if you just talk about iPhone, now it's, today is the first day that in Japan we have two mobile operators carrying the iPhone. It used to be that SoftBank was the only one, so it's very interesting because it carries some competition. And also interesting to see what's going to happen. Will people actually switch from SoftBank to KDDI? The reasoning being the quality of the network is supposedly better at KDDI. Now, theoretically, in terms of data, since you're interested in data, the network of KDDI is actually different. It's not a GSM-based network. It's a CDMA-based network, meaning that theoretically the speeds of the network for data, so the downlink and uplink, is actually lesser than the theoretical speeds of a network like SoftBank's. To be honest, this is all very theoretical, because we will see in the coming days and coming weeks people making tests soon, because I was never able to get the full speed out of my 3G network data on a SoftBank. I was always very content with it because it was really fast, especially compared to other countries I traveled to. Masa-san, the CEO of SoftBank is a very different type of CEO that you can encounter in Japan. He's very vocal. He appears on TV a lot. He does events. He speaks English, by the way, not the quality of his English, that I'll let you decide. But he's a very different breed of Japanese CEO than the usual one you find, which are more in the background. That's why he's both liked and disliked. He uses Twitter a lot. And the other day, I think it was a week ago now, a random user asked him, "Hey, what do you think about the data speed? Is it true that KDDI has data speed that are less than SoftBank's?" And he actually replied in public that, "Oh yeah, effectively," meaning that he's on the offensive, trying to tell his customers and potential new customers that his network is better. You'll tell me. You'll try and you'll tell me. I think the SoftBank's network is very good. I've never reached the theoretical speeds. Nobody has ever reached them, I think. I don't think they actually throttle them. But the number of iPhones that are activated, plus now the other smartphones, mean that obviously it's very hard for any carrier to get full data speed.
You know, one thing I've noticed, when I've come here on vacation before, I've always I have an unlocked 3GS phone that I bought in Thailand. And so I rent a SIM card from a company here called Global Advanced Communications. to use mm-hmm. during my stay here. And the one thing that I've noticed with them and I'm renting another SIM card from Docomo this time, is that the maps feature is not as accurate here as it is in Bangkok. Because when I activate my map and my GPS to find where I am, I find that it jumps around a lot. And you get that figure eight pattern of the interference a lot. Is that a common experience that people complain about, or is it just my phone?
No, I would say, of course, I would say that the... So there's two components in the answer. First of all, I mean, Tokyo is a very dense city with high-rise buildings. In probably all these type of cities, it's actually a little bit more difficult to get an accurate positioning. The other thing is that I don't. So you said you put the both the Docomo and the other company's SIM card with data activated in your iPhone 3GS. Is that correct?
And the other company used SoftBank. And this time I went with this B-Mobile company because their service is with Docomo. And, you know, everyone kept saying how Docomo was so much better.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, I don't notice any significant speed difference between when I rented the SoftBank one.
Yeah, but that's the reason. I mean, we have so Joseph Tame, who is one of the writers for mobile in Japan, and a huge geek. He's the guy who runs the marathons, live streaming it with a few iPads and iPhones, the Tokyo Marathon every year. You should check him out. B-Mobile has access to Docomo's network, but the speeds are actually throttled. They're not having the full access of the network, so you cannot... If you're just using B-Mobile, you won't notice any difference. You actually have to be on Docomo to enjoy the full speed. So actually get a SIM card from Docomo, which as a foreigner, you cannot. Getting data in Japan, if you're not a resident or if you're not a Japanese national, let's say, it's very, very difficult, which is why we wrote that blog entry. But now it's a little bit dated. I think it's a year ago, but still quite a valid. It is actually tough. What I do, now that I'm not a resident of Japan anymore because I travel a lot, I use either two systems. Either a friend of mine actually lends me his iPhone, one of these old iPhones, and then I get everything I want on SoftBank. Or the other, if you like data, I use eMobile. You know, eMobile is like a little, also it's a portable Wi-Fi that I have in my pocket. And I work with both my iPad and my, also my laptop, obviously, and my iPhone. And that actually works very well. Then I don't have to care about voice. Obviously, then I can either roam with my international number or just buy, you know, the lowest, because in Narita, when you arrive, you can buy just a SIM card and a phone that are just for voice, and that's very low, a very low price. So that's the other
thing. Yeah, I looked at the SIM cards at Narita, and they were average about 150 yen per day for only voice. However, if you want to activate the data, it goes up to 1500 yen per day.
It is very expensive.
So if you're not a resident, it's like you said, it's really difficult and expensive to get a data SIM card.
Yeah, it is. And also the other part of the problem is if you actually, you've been walking around Tokyo, you don't find that many free Wi-Fi spots. It's covered by Wi-Fi, but everything is closed. Even the Narita Express, the train that goes from the airport to central Tokyo, has Wi-Fi. The newer ones have Wi-Fi, but you have to register. But in order to register, you have to be a resident. So meaning for business people just coming to visit Japan, there's no way you can access that Wi-Fi. So the best thing, you'll be a resident, so you won't have that problem. But the best thing is always to have friends in the country who actually give you. That's always what I use. I ask friends, oh, can you just, you know, can I borrow your e-mobile for a few days, for a week? And, you know, it's in Japan, when you have these, like, the plans for the iPhone, but that also applies to Android. You have unlimited data plans that are kind of good with great speeds. That you'll see that the prices are actually okay. It's true that compared to some other countries, like for instance the UK, it's still I still find it a little bit expensive in Japan. So the competition is not full on yet. For instance, when KDDI and SoftBank announced their pricing for the iPhone 4S, which is released today, the pricing is not. You cannot really see a huge huge price difference from the state of yesterday, where only the iPhone 4 was offered by SoftBank. There's not a huge difference. There are some offers. They call it launch offers. AUKDDI offers you, I think, a 10,000 yen if you move from another operator. I mean, by the way, they think SoftBank to them. So there are some offers that can make you a sweet deal. But the pricing is surprisingly very, very similar between the two. I've done a comparison. Other websites have done comparisons, and it seems that on a purely number, if you look only at the numbers, SoftBank is a little bit cheaper than AUKDDI for the moment. So you made a good choice.
It's very interesting that Japan has all these advanced phones, and yet they only work in Japan, and none of the other phones from around the world can work in this.
Yeah,
in this country
either. To the point that Nokia, okay, now Nokia is getting a bashing, but back then Nokia actually went out of the Japanese market. They came in, they're number one almost everywhere in the world, from what we call dumb phones, you know, very basic phones, so feature phones to smartphones. They were number one, maybe not on the smartphone front, but they couldn't make a dent. They had less than 1% of the Japanese market. But again, it's because the mobile operators, the carriers, have all the power in Japan. They control everything. They control the specs, the features, even the design of the phone. They control everything. So they were able to push to keep everyone else at bay. And if you didn't agree with their terms, you had no chance to get in. And even if you're like you're Nokia or you're Sony Ericsson and you have a phone that is made for all around the world and you go there and say, hey, here's my phone, but the Docomo or SoftBank or KDDI say, yeah, but no, our specs are different. We would like this and this and this. Now, talking about the features, it's true that in Japan, features in phone, that's why we call them feature phone, were always very impressive compared to the rest of the world. You had NFC, you know, like near field, you could pay with a phone wirelessly, you know, just by touching. Or you'd had, of course, the cameras, a TV, HD TV in your phone, all these features that most of the rest of the world we are now having. It doesn't mean, I mean, they were very advanced, but again, the experience, you know, it's one thing to say it, it's one thing to actually experience it, even though that's basically in 2008 when the iPhone was released and then subsequently the other Android phones, there were many analysts who were saying, oh, there's no way those will work in Japan because, you know, Japan is such a different market and they have these advanced phones, they already do all this shit. So we don't need iPhones. Yeah, right. At the end, all the smartphones are proving to be a huge success, proving that the experiences on these phones that had lots of features was not great.
So the consumers, even though these phones had all these features, still were excited about the iPhone when it came to the market here?
No, not at the beginning. At the beginning, because again, you couldn't access most of the regular service. You know, you have train services to know at what time your train departs. If it's delayed, it never happens. But or weather systems or all the gaming, you know, the for instance, Gree or Dine, Mobageta, which are the biggest mobile kind of a virtual social networks. We can play games, very casual gaming. All the services, you know, when you see advertising, there's a QR code. You can take a picture and go to the dedicated website for a campaign. I mean, there's lots of services that were simply not available on the iPhone and subsequent smartphones because they were, again, the mobile operators had created an whole ecosystem around their own rules. So they were able to control what kind of phone were coming out. And then the iPhone came from the outside, like a foreign phone in brackets. So suddenly, it was a great phone, still is, but it was not completely adapted to the market. So at first, people were kind of hesitating about getting the iPhone. So, but the younger generation bought it. You could often see in trains people having both a Keitai, the traditional clamshell type of a phone you see in Japan, and the iPhone. Also, the keyboard was very different. You can actually write in Japanese, because that's most people do not understand when they have not been in Japan. Writing a text or an email in Japanese is a totally different experience of writing with our 26 letters when we have in English. So the keyboard was a totally newly invented keyboard for the iPhone. So you have to get used to it. It's a totally different experience of what you see on the traditional keytais. So there were all these little hurdles that over time, so the sales, I mean, there's no official numbers of Apple for iPhone sales or iPad sales in any country in the world. We only know, you know, the global number. So it's all guesswork and estimates. But it was really estimated at the beginning that the growth of the sales was slower, the pace was slower than in other countries, the adoption was slower. Also, again, because of loyalty. As I told you before, SoftBank was only number three in the market. So people would say, oh, I'm in Docomo now. I will not switch to SoftBank just for the iPhone. So they wouldn't do it. Same with KDDI. So people, because of both loyalty, novelty, they actually didn't, the pace went slower. But in the meantime, now we estimate that between 7.5 and 8 million iPhones have been sold and maybe a million iPads. So that's a success. There's no other way. It's just, the other proof of the success, if you just go on the App Store, you look at the number of Japanese applications or companies that in Japan have developed applications. That's another proof of the success. They wouldn't be there if Japanese were not using it. And now you can find most of your traditional systems, application services, like trains again, or weather, all these, you can find these on the both and for iPhones and Android. So now it's a success, but still some people have a hard time. And again, it's not on Docomo. So if you're not on Docomo, would you actually buy it? Which is why, if you look at the campaigns Docomo was running and is still running about the Samsung Galaxy, which is the
Android one.
Yeah, it's the Android that is put as the iHand Android phone. Right. The campaign look very similar to the iPhone. It's basically telling Docomo people, okay, you cannot have the iPhone, but here is, you know, we have better. That's called Samsung Galaxy S. And now the Samsung Galaxy S2. And it proves to be a very big, a huge success. I remember the day Docomo announced it. I think there were like just, you know, in under an hour. I don't have the numbers. I don't remember the numbers. So I wouldn't say something stupid, but the number of pre-orders were staggering. People were crying to get smartphones on Docomo. And so it's a big success, which is why also Docomo now, to come back to your earlier question, doesn't have the same pressure to get the iPhone that it used to. So, you know, we have a huge, our Android strategy works well.
What do you kind of see for the future of the Japanese mobile market? Cause like you mentioned, it's been very inwardly looking for a long time. However, with phones like the iPhone, which is a global phone, and these other Android makers making global phones, and then you have Japan, which has a shrinking population, and you even said that the early adopters of the iPhone were the younger folks. What do you think for this kind of closed market?
Yeah, first of all, in terms of purely smartphones, it's considered that by 2015, so in less than four years. Smartphones will have taken over the market in Japan. So you're not that keytais will have died completely, but smartphones will have taken the market over. So for me, there's clearly before July 11, 2008 and after July 11, 2008, meaning there's before and after the iPhone. It's not because of the iPhone. It could have been the Android. It was the first phone to disrupt the traditional model of, again, these mobile operators controlling everything. So it has changed the Japanese market. It has kind of reached a little bit into that Galapagos syndrome, where, you know, but there'll still be, you know, it's still a different market. The type of services people are using in Japan, most of them you cannot see them anywhere else in the world. Again, I'm mentioning these casual gaming. I mean, we have casual gaming. You have Angry Birds. You know, I mean, all these casual games, you have them on other platforms. But I mean, these virtual networks like Ri and Mobageta, are not really as prevalent in other places in the world. So there are specificities of the Japanese market that will remain. So the only thing I think that the hardware, so the phones will less and less be made by Japanese providers, but by, you know, HTC, Samsung, obviously Apple and others. But there will still be, however, specificities in the market. It will be at most, like for someone like you, if you, let's say you move to Japan, instead of moving now to Japan and you move in 5 years, it will be a market that will recognize most because it will be closer to what you experience outside. You'll have the same type of smartphones. You'll have HTCs and Samsung again. So you won't be a totally different world. When I came there, I remember it was like, okay, these phones look awesome. I've never seen those. They have TV on them, but they were like completely different from what I was used to. So this will be closer to other markets. What I'm not sure about, people say it's the end of the Galapagos. I'm not actually completely sure because of the language and because of the still the possibility of, you know, Docomo, for instance, is a massive, it's a mammoth. It's a huge, it's one of the biggest telcos in the world. They can actually create their own applications. They might not be able to control the App Store or App Market on Android anymore, their apps, but they can actually create apps that are, since no one else will actually create applications from Japan unless you're in Japan and you know Japan, with their marketing power, and their resources, the financial resources, they could actually create a lot of applications that like people will actually use, they could market. And in that sense, the Galapagos syndrome would remain a little bit because an app that is marketed by Docomo and that is put everywhere, and I tell the customer, okay, you should use this. Customers might actually use it, and then you'll have your Android or your iPhone. You go to Japan for the first time, and you open a friend's iPhone, and you look at it and say, oh, this is great, but I do not recognize any of the applications. So it could be a little bit like this. I'm exaggerating because there's some applications that be worldwide, but that it will still remain a little bit a different market, but most recognizable.
Yeah, I definitely think that any disruption to the Galapagos syndrome, in my opinion, is a good thing for Japan. Yeah. I think that that mindset is not going to help Japan going forward. And I really like to see the success of Android and iPhones here to kind of disrupt these old companies and force them to try to do things differently.
But actually, companies in Japan are capable of. I see a lot of, I work a lot with brands and advertisers as well. And you have Docomo when they partner with Dentsu, for instance, which is an advertising company. They create some awesome, you know, services or applications or sometimes they're only prototypes. They are capable in software because that's always a thing. When you think about Japan, let's go out a little bit of the mobile phone. When you think about Japan, when you ask anyone, can you name me a consumer electronics? Yeah, they can name you Sony, Nintendo, you know, they can name you lots and lots and lots of companies. But if you ask them, can you name me a web service? Or can you name me a software company? No one is able to. Unless you've lived in Japan, you have no idea about any software or of web service coming out of Japan. But when I see what, again, I'm talking about Docomo, but I'm sure the others could do that. When I see some of the software, because applications are basically software, it comes out of some prototypes. I'm saying, yeah, they have amazing ideas. And also they have these, again, we're talking about the casual gaming thing, about Gree and Mobile Guitar. They have these experiences. Nowadays, everywhere all over the world, you're looking at Angry Birds and other, or Farmville, you know, these stuff on this game on Facebook. These are games that you can find in Japan already, or you can find obviously in South Korea and in China as well. But they have experience over a world that is coming to all of us around the world. Japan has a lot to offer. And also Japan has one thing that is fascinating to offer is content. You have this fascination about obviously the manga culture, but not only. If you go to, just go. I mean, you've been in Bangkok. It's been a very, very long time I haven't been, so I wouldn't be able to tell you about Bangkok. But if you just go to Singapore, or even if you go to some parts of Manila, you see that the Japanese culture, not directly, but indirectly, by the clothes they wear, the kind of shows they like, there is an influence. And that's an influence that Japan was not used to. Japan was always thinking of the influence about hardware, about, you know, selling you a camera, selling you a Sony, but Now, they have this possibility. So content plus software is actually very potent. If they understand how to do it, they're still going to be very valid.
That's actually a really interesting point, because, you know, that's something I've always thought about too, is that when you think of Japanese exports, you think of gadgets and cars. But their kind of culture, and like you said, their content is actually a fairly strong export as well. And you know, Steve Jobs has always said that what makes Macintosh computers and iPods great isn't so much the hardware, but it's the software. It's the stuff on the inside that makes it great. So I agree with you that I think that that's something that Japan could really capitalize on, especially in the mobile market, because they have such a huge lead in creating mobile games and all these other specific apps that I think they could really capitalize on that around the world if they choose to.
Yeah, I agree. And Japan, the thing, what I think is, if you look at history of Japan, Japan is very good at adapting. Japan, so now they have, let's talk mobile operators. They had this grip on the market, you know, they didn't have to care about competition much. And then suddenly, the rules of the games have changed. They will adapt. And I'm sure they can come up with stuff that will amaze all of us. So it's I agree with people that say there are sometimes dinosaurs, but that, you know, pretty much a lot of corporations in the world can be called dinosaurs. If you look at what HP is doing nowadays, it's a huge mess. Right. So it's not only, okay, it's sure the structure of Japanese companies is different, but they will adapt. They might take their time. Maybe some will take a bigger hit than others, but I think they will adapt. And they still have, if we just talk Japan, they still have a market that is still very different, if only for the language. I mean, if you're a developer, a software developer living in the U.S., even though Japan is a very important market because it's 127 million people and you want to break in there, I mean, it's such a hassle to, if you do not speak Japanese, it's such a hassle to actually localize your software, let's say, that you might better think, oh, I might go to Europe and Russia and South America. I mean, all these countries, you know, they speak English, and then you have economies of scale with Spanish, for instance. So Japan will, that's why I'm saying that Japan will still be a little bit of an outlier, because companies in Japan will still have the advantage of being in Japan and understanding a very different culture and market. So I'll see. I think the hardware part is completely disrupted. I think it offers better choice to consumers. I hope to see more price wars, because the quality of the network, if we talk about mobile, is, I mean, impressive. The speeds, obviously, for your broadband at home, for instance, are impressive, like in South Korea. I mean, there's a lot of stuff where it's really impressive. But I would love to see for smartphones a little bit more of a price war that we have experienced in some other parts of the world. That would be my hope for 2012.
Well, I definitely think that the iPhone certainly has put a dent in the market, if you will, in Japan. And let's hope for more disruption in pricing and services going forward.
Exactly. I'm with you there.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me, Paul. I really appreciate it. If you want to check out more information from his website, it's mobileinjapan.com. Has all the latest prices about the iPhone for KDDI and SoftBank. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you had me. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it. That wraps up another episode of Tokyo Podcast. For more information about the iPhone 4S and mobile phones in general in Japan, check out mobileinjapan.com. For the latest news about the flood situation in Thailand, look for Richard Barrow, B-A-R-R-O-W, on Twitter or the Facebook page that I mentioned earlier, which is facebook.com/ThaiFloodENG. And if you want to follow my good friend Greg Jorgensen's latest adventures in Thailand, he's getting married in a couple weeks. That's going to be a big adventure. Look for his website at greg2differ.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.